Well, this is going to be very interesting tonight because my children tell me that I start looking a little glassy-eyed about 5:30, sleepy at 6, and I'm out by 6:30. So in 9 minutes, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And then I wake up at, I start waking up about 2:30 and roll around and think and, you know, count sheep, and finally at 3:30 get up and not want to waste any more of the day. So that's my normal schedule. So this is going to be very interesting tonight. And what I've worked out is with Les, he's going to answer any that I get petered out on. So you saw that hand. It'll be a blessing. But let's see. Good. So here we go. The microphones are right there. We have two of them. And until it's time to send off our Nepal team, we'll see what we can come up with. If there's no questions, we'll send off the Nepal team early. So, and you just come up to the microphone and just ask your question. Who will be first? Oh, there we come. Hello, my name is
Carolina. And Pastor Jeff has been preaching on 1 Peter 2 about biblical submission. And so I was wondering, when Peter says to submit to the authorities, how does the civil rights movement fit in with that?
Submit to authority, and how does the civil right, what part of civil rights are you talking about?
Mainly in the 60s during the marches and the sit-ins and... Mm.
And where do strikes fit in? Marches, sit-ins, all of that. That's a good question, Carolina. Let's first look at what Peter says, and then we'll go back to Paul's. So we can go to 1 Peter, where he tells us in chapter, I think it's 2, 1 Peter 2, starting in verse 13 onward, it says, "Therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether the king is supreme, or to governors as those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who are good. For this is the will of God." You know, a lot of people are always wondering what the will of God is. There are five times it very clearly says this is the will of God. And this one is one. "This is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, not using your liberty as a cloak for vice, as bondservants." And then he lays it on in verse 17, "Honor all people." We should be the least prejudiced, the least discriminatory, the least sarcastic, the least racially anything people in the world. We're supposed to honor everybody. We're supposed to love the brotherhood that's in Christ. Of course, fear God. And then the kicker is honor the flagrant, open, homosexual activist himself, Nero, the king, which is amazing, because that's what, I mean, the killer of the Christians, honor him. And then he goes through servants and everything else. So what Caroline asks is, how do you submit to authority? What about the civil rights, all the stuff that went on? And I can add to that, strikes. Because my father, who worked for General Motors, it seemed like they were in the early, late 50s and early 60s, it seems like they were on strike every other month, you know? And then I remember when I was a member of the Teamsters, when I worked for United Parcel Service, that's the one thing that I finally decided I couldn't keep working for them and be a Teamster and, be a Teamster, and fight for, with the Brotherhood, with the other Teamsters. So what it says is that we're supposed to submit to the ordinance of man. That means that we pay our taxes even if we think that the government does bad things with it, because the government has always done bad things with it. The taxes that the Apostle Paul paid and that Peter paid by way of the Roman occupation funded the lavish orgies of the king, Nero. I mean, they did. And so this new thing we have nowadays, that we protest everything and we don't, there are actually Christians that don't pay their taxes and they consider it godly. It might in their minds be godly, but it's not biblical here. And so we have to be very cautious to work with the text. The scriptures make Christians to be the most law-abiding, solid citizens of all. And that's where Christians upholded all of the government's rights until they crossed over into direct disobedience. And so for civil rights, it is always wrong to discriminate against anyone. It's always wrong. Yet, Christians were on both sides of the civil rights. The South, many of them were as segregated as you could be. What's so interesting is that we have the same Bible. And if you ever want to read about it, there's a great book on this called Slavery, Segregation, and the Scriptures by J. Oliver Buswell. And he talks about, because I hear many people saying, how come the Bible, right there in that verse I stopped on, verse 18, talks about slaves? And how can the Bible at all speak to the 21st century when it regulates slavery? The Bible regulated how people were to behave within the cultural context. So if there ever is a period in time when there's history, the people who honored God, if there were slavery, they were supposed to be the ones who treated their slaves with the utmost respect, with the utmost care, with no, you know, mistreatment of them, and to rightly pay them and everything else, because slavery was endemic. It was part of the fabric of the ancient world. And so all God did is he didn't condone and he didn't condemn. He just said, if you're a master, you're actually going to answer to me. And if you're a slave, you're actually going to answer to me and go. So number one, submission to government is clear. Now, if you back up to Romans 13, Paul enlarges on that beyond what Peter says. And we'll get into the the sit-ins and all that that Carolina talked about. But Romans 13 talks about the, starting in verse 1, let every soul be subject. And so basically, the word hupotasso means that you line up behind. It isn't that you obey everything they say. You line up behind everything that they're in charge of. That means that they're in charge of the taxation, that they're in charge of the laws and rules. And so in all of the areas where they don't impinge, where they don't cross over, as the apostle said, we have to serve God rather than man. But there are so few things we protest that actually are about serving God. It gets into us being concerned personally for, you know, our financial or our preferences. But it says there are no authorities except from God, verse 1. And the authorities exist or appointed by God. And I think that's part of the submission we were talking about this morning, even the trusting God aspect, that we know for sure that God himself placed Bill Clinton, Obama, and all the Republican presidents around them in office. You know, a lot of people are celebrating. They think that our newest president is like an answer from the Lord. The previous one was too. Because look what it says in verse 1. They are, all authorities that exist are appointed by God. He actually raises up and puts down kings. So what happens when we don't like the authorities, like whether it's segregation, you know, the civil rights movement and all that? Verse 2, therefore, whoever resists authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but evil. Do you want to be unafraid of authority? Do what is good, and you have praise. Now we get into what happens when the government puts into place laws that are unbiblical. Then comes the fact that Christians, we should be the ones that are most citing what God's moral code is. And we should be the ones, actually it should be that we who believe and know the Bible should be the ones that are saying that God has no respect of persons, that mankind is made of one blood, that there are no racial divisions. There aren't three races, there's only one. And it says in Acts 17, God has made from one blood all the nations of the earth and has appointed their habitations. So with God, he is colorblind and there's no racial distinction. Mankind and our humanness and our sinfulness and our selfishness and all that has raised those divisions. And so what do we do with society? Well, The best thing to do is to just keep repeating the scriptures and explaining it and stand for it and take part in the process. Remember, we think of the empire being monolithic. Actually, Rome had a system of laws and representation. If you read, and that's another book, I mean, if you really like to study this, there's a book called Daily Life in Ancient Rome. It was a Yale dissertation by a guy named Carcupino. Carcupino. And Daily Life, Ancient Rome. And it's a classic, just like Slavery, Segregation, the Scriptures. And Carcupino shows that there was absolutely at every level, from what we would call the local, the precinct, all the way up, there was representation in the Roman government. There was an emperor, but there still was an amazing amount of local governance that Christians could, if they were citizens, could be involved in. Remember, Paul took advantage of, he knew his rights and he expressed them. So in every level that we can express the truth, we should. But what about marches? Well, it depends. It depends on whether or not we want to be identified with those who are not submitting, usually people that are involved in resistance movements, which we see a lot of resistance now, that's what it's being called, the political thing, aren't just against the ones that are against the scriptures. They're against all of their social issues, their agenda. So Christians have to be very careful about getting involved in something that is a wholesale kind of resistance to one whole direction, you know, the military-industrial complex or whatever they're protesting. And that whole civil rights thing got caught up in a lot of other parts. Now, for me, I believe that we should be representing non-discriminatory, total racial equality and biblical standards. Do I believe personally that you march for it? I don't. Sit in? No. Speak? Yes. But always, that's just my personal, I mean, I don't even like parties or crowds, so, you know, don't ask me that. I would rather study. But for some people, they love to represent Christ in the marketplace, and as long as you're representing Christ. Now remember, he was not loud, boisterous, and fighting, except for God, twice, cleaning out the temple. Did Jesus say anything about the injustices? Yeah. Remember, when he's preaching along, he tells them, if you're discontent with your wages, don't be. Whoa. So Jesus was not for strikes. Do you remember when, you know, actually John the Baptist is the one that told them, the soldiers, if you don't like your wages, you know, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to go to strike? No. But what we're supposed to see is we do stand for right, but as far as a biblical mandate for resistance, aggressive resistance, even to the form of overthrow, I'm glad Carolina didn't ask me my opinion of the American Revolution, because it's not very good. Revolutions aren't really ordained in the scripture. Rather, the standing for what is right and being willing to suffer for what is right, but not to overthrow. Overthrow isn't a real biblical concept. So Caroline, if you just want my opinion, we're always supposed to submit to authority. That's what Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 say. And when the authority is wrong, we stand up, as Daniel did. As, you know, the three, you know, in the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as each one that we see standing up for what is wrong and representing God and the apostles and the early believers, saying we ought to obey God rather than man, make sure it's a biblical issue. Make sure it's actually something that I am commanded to do. I'm not commanded to be discriminatory. Our country might be, but our country is pagan. Our country will never be Christian. We cannot Christianize America or any other nation. So, see, that's where Christians, they're fighting to Christianize something that can never be Christian. A nation can never be Christian. God couldn't even run a theocracy directly there without killing people to make them obey. God does not force us to obey. We cannot force pagans to take Christian values. We can live it, we can stand for it, we can proclaim it, but to be known as an activist for civil rights when we're not known as an activist for Christ, for salvation. See, that's what's so interesting. People will get totally caught up in civil rights or environmental rights or whatever that have never taken a stand. You never see them on the corner preaching, but they'll protest or sit in or whatever, resist. When, which is worse, to be discriminated against or go to hell? Which is worse? And yet they get worked up over the discrimination rather than over the lostness of the world. So, and I'm going to go beyond the question. So, Carolina, where did you go? Oh, right there. Did I say enough? Because I'm going to get in trouble because I am getting tired and tired. So she releases me from saying any more. Okay. Thank you, Carolina. And no follow-up question on that. So, okay, who else has a microphone question here?
So if God were like...
Hello, my name is...
Oh, sorry. My name is Krista.
Say it again.
Krista Hoff.
I can't. It's only over there. Say it again.
Just say
Crystal.
Write down K-H.
Like Crystal?
Sure. Just sure.
I'll have to stand over here. Okay.
So if... God, is God so bad on gays? Because people tell me he is. Yeah, I just heard that that it's, because I heard someone was gay in the Bible, so I don't know.
Yeah, there were many gay. Actually, the biblical word is homosexuality. But that's, you're calling gays homosexual. But some gays in the Bible. And is God, what'd you say, bad on gays? That's a good question. What else?
That's all.
That's all. Okay. It wasn't Crystal. Here, I'm going to come right next to this thing. What was it?
Krista Hall.
Krista. Oh, Krista. Like with a K or a C?
K.
Krista. There we go. Okay, number one, is God bad on gays? No more so than on any other sin. I think we have to realize that homosexuality is not the ultimate sin. The ultimate sin, the first sin, and the most pervasive sin is pride. So homosexuality is on the same level as far as in the punishment for sin as all other sins. Now, what is the societal impact that homosexuality has? It's huge. It's huge. And you can see if we allow it to keep going, it's going to basically just destroy the entire family unit as God knows it. Because now we have two women as parents, two men as parents, a single man as a parent. I mean, we have no idea of the origin. So let's go back. I mean, I love talking about doctrines in a biblical theological way. We know that it says in the beginning, God created in Genesis 1 and 2. So there's a creation mandate. God made man first. So he created male. And from man, he created female. And what's interesting about that is even the Hebrew word for male is ish, or man, it's ish. And for woman, the Hebrew word is isha. And you know what that's interesting? Out of man. So God made, created Adam, out of Adam created Eve, and then he explained that one man and one woman was his, you know, in chapter 2, He says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, they shall become one flesh. So the entire sexual invention of God, remember, God invented sexuality. So it's not bad, it's good. And God made two orientations. He made male and female. And God said that his perfect design in the womb, Psalm 139, God designed us as either male or female. Satan is the one who wants androgyny. He's the one who wants to blur this. Why? Because God, and this is not an issue of gays. This is an issue of submission to the order and plan of God. God, the bigger picture is actually in 1 Corinthians 11. And basically what God says is that God is the head of Christ, as Christ is the head of the church. And that is supposed to parallel as the husband is the head of the wife, and the children are to submit to their parents. So the whole, when Paul starts talking about sexual identity and does the whole 1 Corinthians 11 head covering and talks about the role of women and the role of men, he goes back not to the fall. He does that in other terms for teaching and for leading. But when he just talks about male and female, he said, for as the Father is the head of Christ, and Christ is the head of the church, the husband is to be head of the wife, and the wife is to be the one who, with the husband, oversees the children, but primarily she is the one that is entrusted in Titus 2 with the care of the children and the care of the home. What I just said would cause protests. I mean, that has become a societal, combustible issue. It's just God saying that he designed husbands to be males, he designed wives to be females, he designed children to be male and female, and to learn their role in life by watching their mother, the wife, rightly line up in her gender-specific role, not her worth. This is not. Is Christ inferior in worth to God? The idea of headship, the idea of headship is not worth, it's role. The role of God is Father. The role of Christ is Son. And there's no inferiority that is implied. It's roles. Even within the Trinity, there are Trinitarian roles. Not greater or lesser worth. So a wife that submits, it doesn't say obey, by the way. The word obey is not the word submit. Submit is line up in gender-specific role. Obey is I have someone that, kind of like a master to the servant. That is not how the Bible portrays husbands and wives or men and women. By the way, there's only a gender-specific role in two realms, the church and the home. It says nothing in the Bible about the role of women outside of the church and the home. They can be the president, the queen, the C, everything, CE, CF, C, whatever. But so the whole homosexual issue is to blur this, because as soon as a person rejects their gender, their identity, their sexual orientation given them by God. Now you say, what about, I know that one out of every, 100,000 babies born is born, and I don't even know the medical term, but they're born both or half or whatever. There's all these, yes. You never make doctrines based on the exceptions. Because of sin, because of the curse, because of genetic, degeneration, there are always going to be mutations. But the perfect creation of God made husbands as males and men as males. And yes, there's been, you know, genetic decay, but the original creation is that men are men and they stay men. I mean, we just came from a country that's the capital of transvestitism. It's the place of the she-men, the she-boys, or whatever they call them there, where they're just proliferated to be female men. And it's just amazing. So what does the Lord say? Back to Krista's question. Is God bad on gays? No, he's not. For every single homosexual, like every single glutton and liar and proud person and anxious person and fearful person and gossiping person and, you know, stingy person and envious person, I mean, I'm just talking about every sin. For every single one of them, Jesus Christ died for the sin of the world. It says in John 1:29 that Jesus was the Lamb of God who didn't die for the sins, plural. He died for the sin, as Spurgeon put it in his commentary, the totality of the mass of the sin of the world. So on the cross, Jesus died for sin, homosexuality and pride and greed and everything else. But that sin is damnable. It's interesting, the homosexuality shows up. In fact, let's just look at it. Look at Romans 1 to see how bad God is. He's bad on a lot of sins. Look at the company homosexuality is in. Romans chapter 1, and Paul rattles off, lists off all of the sins that are there. And so the Lord talks about verse 27, likewise the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men. Actually, that's a translation to put away, you know, a little embarrassment. It isn't with. The word is en, E-N. It's men in men, literally, is what it is. It was a very graphic term. And Paul said, men, en, or in, men, committing what is shameful, receive in themselves a penalty of their error, which was due. But then he talks about verse 28, you know, why they do it. But look at verse 29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness. Do you know, covetousness drives the American economy. We covet other people's houses. In fact, we start pin boards with pictures of them until we can figure out how we can have one like that. And we sacrifice for our covetousness. How many people sacrifice family and serving the Lord for economic reasons? They work second shift, third shift, fifth shift, tenth shift, three jobs, whatever. Instead of lowering their expenses to meet their income, they kill themselves to raise their income to meet their never-ending desires. It's interesting. One of the best ways to solve financial problems is to just downsize until you can afford whatever you have. And then, you know, learn somehow to balance that out rather than ever try and want, you know, if you're not happy with what you have, you'll never be happy with what you want. And as soon as you learn that, it just liberates you, because you just have to learn to be thankful with that. But look what he says here. Look at the bad company. Maliciousness, envy, murder, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, inventors of evil things. Look at the end of verse 30. If God is bad on gays, he's also bad on people that are, what does the last part of verse 30 say? Disobedient to what? So children that are disobedient to parents are in the same list as murderers and homosexuals. In God's mind, is he bad on gays? He's bad on sinners. He loves them, but unless they repent, all sin. You can go to hell as fast for gluttony as for murder or rape or homosexuality. There's really no cardinal, I mean, that's an invention of the church, the cardinal and the venial. No, sin. Pride is the worst. So, are there some gays in the Bible? Yes. Look at 1 Corinthians 6. Now let's turn over from Romans 1 to 1 Corinthians 6, because it says in verse 9, "Do you not know that the unrighteous will inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators," that's actually the word pornos, porno, porno, pornos, okay? So neither pornos nor idolaters. What's an idolater? Someone that puts a physical object ahead of God and they give their devotion to it. There are people that are idolatrous of their cars. There are people that are idolatrous of their partner. They are sexual idolaters. There's financial idolaters. There's all kinds of, I mean, you don't have to go to Tibet and, you know, or any of the Buddhist countries and have a little Buddha to be an idolater. It's something, you know what it says in the Minor Prophets? It says that they worship their nets. They worship their nets. Fishermen worship their nets. They bow before their net more than they bow before God. It's interesting. Our careers can be a form of idolatry. But he says, some of you are idolaters, nor adulterers. Fornicators are people that are interested but they're not married. And adulterers are interested in other sexual things, and they are married. And look at, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites. You say, is there a difference between a homosexual and a sodomite? Yeah. One is the active and one is the passive. It's very interesting that there are people that are actually the second one there, the sodomites, is arsenet coitus. It's in bed with a man, literally is what it says. A man in bed with a man. And it's just amazing that God singles out both. But then look what it says, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners will inherit the kingdom of God. So God is bad on sin, but here is the second question. Were there some gays in the Bible? Look at verse 11. There's your answer, Krista. And such were some of you. Wow. Isn't that amazing that the church in Corinth, Paul was writing to a church where there were former, what a gang went to that church, fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, homosexuals, sodomites, thieves, covetous, drunkards, revilers, extortioners. And such were, verse 11, some of you, but you were washed, but you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of the Lord and by the Spirit of God. Wow. I know for me, and I've told you this story many times, but the first homosexual I ever led to the Lord, his name was Al. And I met him on the phone at 2 a.m. every night. He called the parsonage at 2 a.m. When I started going verse by verse through the book of Romans in 1989, he didn't like it. The gay community of Boston and Cape Cod, they didn't have to listen to our television show or our radio show, but they did, just to get mad. And so he would call the parsonage and let it ring to wake up my little children at 2 a.m. And every night I'd go down and it would be ringing like clockwork at 2, and I'd pick it up and I held it like this. By the way, a telephone used to have a cord on it and it went to the wall. And it was in one place and it stayed there and it made this shrill sound until you made it stop. And so I would run down the stairs and pick the phone up, but after the first two times, I learned you didn't put it by your ear, because he screamed and yelled 4 and 6 and 12-letter words. I mean, he was really knew how to swear. And I would hold it away, and he would just cuss me out. And I'd say, you know, thank you, and I'd hang up. You know, I didn't want to hang up without saying thank you, you know. And because when you're reviled, revile not again, you're Christ-like. So I thanked him and for reviling me, and I hung up. But night after night after night, even in your, you know, tiredness like I am right now, you can hear. And I started recognizing that sound. And concurrent with the 2 a.m. phone calls was the arrival of the man who never looked up in the balcony. And he started coming in after the service started, and every time I said, in conclusion, he would stand up. I thought it was the most curious thing. I'd go, in conclusion, boom. It was like a jack-in-the-box, you know, pop. He popped out of his chair and went down the stairway. And I started wondering, is there a correspondence between my 2 a.m. and my jack-in-the-box, you know? And so I didn't say in conclusion one Sunday. And I just preached walking down the aisle, and I stood right by the stairwell and asked the chairman to close in prayer. And I stood there, and he started coming down. He caught the drift. He saw me walking, and he got right up and down the stairs. And so I went over. So he moved over. So I moved over. So he moved over like this. And I was not letting him down the stairs, and I was trying to see his face because he never looked up. And finally, he said, excuse me, because he was going to push by me. And I said, I recognize your voice. You're my 2 a.m. friend. And he looked me right in the eye. And I said, I would love to talk to you. So at 2 a.m., he called again. Only he didn't cuss. He said, would you really meet with me? I said, I would really meet with you, but please don't call me at 2 o'clock to set it up, you know. Called during office hours. But we set it up, and I met him, and Al became a dear friend of mine. He had had 600 homosexual partners. He'd had reconstructive surgery because homosexuals are so jealous of each other that they brick one another. They wrap up bricks in cloth or a towel, and they hit each other in the face because it can break bones. And it's a way that you get back at each other. And he told me how many times he'd been bricked, but why he came to us was we're the church that gave him his HIV notice. We ran a clinic downtown Providence, free, confidential. And our medical personnel, this is way back in the 80s when it was just starting, they would do the test and they would write and seal an envelope and give it back to the person, and they passed it to him and it said, you are HIV positive. And he got angry at everybody, his 600 partners, God, and the people that gave him the slip, our church. And so he decided he would protest by cussing me out. And you know all he needed was, verse 11, but you were washed. And I remember sharing the gospel with him, and he never looked up until this point, because this has always been the Bible, and this is the first place I went with him. I said, you're in the Bible, Al. You're a homosexual and sodomite. He said, I am. I said, but look at verse 11. Such were some of you. I said, God can put that in the past tense. And God can wash you of your guilt. God can sanctify you. What is sanctification? Making us useful to God. And he can justify you. What is justification? I said, Al, God, if you will call out to him right now, will treat Jesus Christ like he was a homosexual sodomite. Boy, does that get people's attention. They can't imagine Jesus. Even a homosexual can't imagine Jesus being as bad as them. And he said, no. I said, yes. And that's the first time he looked up. He looked up at me. He said, really? I said, and right there he dropped to his knees, called the name of the Lord, and found out that God is not bad on gays. God is bad on unrepentant sinners who will refuse his kindness and his mercy and his grace, which he extends in his great love wherewith he loved us while we were still sinners. And Al became the most radiant, dying, HIV-positive person you ever saw, packing his Gideon Bibles, packing his tracts, sharing the gospel, wanting to be baptized. That was another hoot. I mean, no one knew about HIV back then, and so, and AIDS. It was just kind of thought to be like leprosy. And so he wanted to be baptized, and we had lots of people being baptized, and I asked the elders, and they said, no, it might transmit. And I said, come on. And they said, okay, last. He has to be last in the line. And I said, okay, last. And so all the other people got baptized, and then when it was cleared out, Al came, down the steps. And I got him down there to the microphone. He gave the most moving testimony of, such were some of you, but you're washed. I mean, it wasn't a dry eye in the place, and he talked about it. While he was testifying, I heard the sound of something in the water. And I looked up, and the 84-year-old chairman of the deacons had a great big gallon of Clorox dumping it in the baptistry, trying to save my life from getting, you know, AIDS, and thought Clorox would kill it. And so here I am with Al, with a gallon of Clorox, baptizing him. And when he came up out of the water, it is just one of those sights you'll never forget, of the full, joyful, radiant, wide-eyed joy at being washed in the process of lifelong sanctification and justified freely by the grace that's in Christ Jesus. So, Krista, is God bad on gays? No. If you'd asked me in your third or fourth question, I would have talked to you about the fact that I believe that all of us were born any sinners. You know, we can be anything. Do you think anybody was born a murderer? They became a murderer through anger and, you know, and resentment, and it just built, and finally they go into murder. Homosexuality is just a form of sexual temptation. Sexual desire is like a river. As long as it's kept within the banks, it's okay. As long as the river stays between the two banks, it's okay. It's when it spills over the banks, when it floods over the banks, that's when it's bad. Sexual desire is designed by God at creation. He invented sexuality. In fact, God thinks it's so wonderful that he compares the love of the in Song of Solomon, he compares the love of Solomon for that servant girl with Christ's love for the church. That's just astounding to think that God thinks in those terms because he invented it. But from creation, males are to love females. But males can learn to love males. They can be tempted, and they can be continuing in that process, and they can go outside the banks of the river and put their desire in the wrong direction instead of this way. Now, a male who has desire for a female that he's not married to is fornication. And a male who has desire for a female when he's married to someone else, it's adultery. But a male that has a desire for a female that stays inside the banks of marriage, lifelong fidelity and commitment and covenant, there's nothing wrong. The marriage bed, Hebrews 13 of Hebrews, the marriage bed is undefiled. God says, I invented sex. I want you to be as sexual. I want you to be, as it says in Proverbs 5, intoxicated with your partner. That's how God designed it. But Satan doesn't want that. Satan wants males to desire males, females to desire females. He wants males to be mixed up and not follow their gender-specific role. You know, that's what's going on in our culture right now. God is head of Christ. Christ is head of the church. Husband's supposed to be head of wife. Did you know that we have what I call, you know, PMS, passive male syndrome? Basically, wives run the families, kids are co-pilots, and dad is down here somewhere, passively. And it raises a group of children that are totally mixed up on the roles. They think mom is in charge, and they think that's what God designed, and it's not. And it's deleterious and destructive to their raising because they don't know what they're supposed to do. They don't see a gender-specific role for a man to be the leader and for the wife to respond to the man as the church responds to Christ, as Christ is headed by God. And so homosexuality is just a manifestation of the whole deconstruction of the scriptures, of the order of God, of submission to the scriptures. And it's no worse than any other sin, except long-term. It has a caustic, destructive quality for God's design for the home. And also, as we see in the homosexuality, there is there is a slow decline, and we see that with what happened to the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, that it gradually eroded and contaminated. When public homosexuality took over in the Roman Empire with the emperors, it was part of the rust that ended up destroying. And what we're seeing now is Western culture is being eroded by this flagrant homosexuality that's always been with us. But Krista, where did you go? Where? Right there? Did I say enough? You can follow up next week, because we're having another one of these next week, okay? Think of more ramifications, and I'll be more awake by next week, okay? You have another question? We have a send-off. How about 4 minutes? What is your other question? Yeah. Do you have one more question? We have a follow-up.
So if someone like prays to God, God will forgive them?
Absolutely.
But how do you keep up with being so good and so perfect?
Christians aren't perfect. They're just forgiven. And the answer to that is right here. And you ought to look this up. It says in the scriptures, in Titus 2, that the grace of God that brings salvation teaches us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly. The only way that we live soberly, righteously, and godly is by the grace of God. And grace is freely offered to humble people. People that say, I can't obey. I don't have enough strength to be good. And see, self-righteousness is that I try harder and harder and harder to follow some rules. Grace is, no matter how hard I try, I can't keep them. And so I cry out to you. It's kind of like not knowing how to swim, drowning in the water, and crying out for help and putting out your hand and grabbing a hand. That's what grace is. It's when we grab the hand of the Lord and he pulls us out. But we're never totally delivered from sin in this world.
Okay.
So you still have temptations, sexual temptations, pride temptations, everything else.
I've done so much bad, it's almost like I ain't going to hell right from the beginning.
That's how all of us are. We all have sinned so much, it's like we all deserve hell. But the Lord sent his grace to set us free. And did you know what? You're surrounded by forgiven sinners. We're all convicts. Everybody in this room, basically, are convicts. They're all convicted sinners in different forms. Some sexual, some material, some social sins, some verbal sins. We're all sinners.
Okay.
But we've been forgiven of all sins. So keep thinking and have your next week's question and come back next week, okay?
Okay.